We're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, translations and purports by Sublime Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. First canto, 19th chapter, 29th text.
Shamam sarati vyavayam galashmya
Shamam sarati
Shamam sarati vyavayam galashmya
Shamam sarati
vyavayam galashmya Vinam dena
Translation by Srila Prabhupada. He was blackish and very beautiful due to his youth. Because of the glamour of his body and his attractive smile, he was pleasing to women. Though he tried to cover his natural glories, the great sages present there were all expert in the art of physiognomy, and so they honored him by rising from their seats. There's no purport to this verse, so I'm going to read the next one. And the purport then comes. X29.
So, Vishnurato Pitaya Agataya Dasmai Sabaryam Shirasa Jaharo Tathoni Vrita Yavudatriyod Bakan Hasane Sabavivesha Bhujita.
Sa is he, Vishnurata, Maharaj Parikshit, who is always protected by Lord Vishnu. Atitaye, to become a guest. You know that word, Atiti, Narayan, means the uninvited guest.
Agataya, one who arrived there. Tasmai,
unto him.
Sapayam, with the whole body. Shirasa,
with bowed head. I guess we can say these all together.
Ajahara,
offered obeisances.
Thereafter.
Nivrita. Certainly.
Abhuta.
Less intelligent.
Striya.
Women.
Abhaka.
Boys.
Mahasane.
Exalted.
Exalted.
Seat. Now I guess we have Mahasana, so Asana's a seat. Maha means great, exalted seat. And another word that we should all know. Abhuta. Buddha means intelligence, right? And Maha means not or without, so less intelligent.
Sa.
He.
Upadi
Vesha.
Sat down.
Pujita. Being respected. Another word, puja, worship, respect. Translation by Srila Prabhupada.
Maharaj Parikshit,
who is also known as Vishnurata, one who is always protected by Vishnu, bowed his head to receive the chief guest, Shukadeva Goswami. At that time, all the ignorant women and boys ceased following Srila Shukadeva. Receiving respect from all, Shukadeva Goswami took his exalted seat. That's another word we know, but I guess it comes from Raka, to protect. Mari Krishna Raki Ke Raki Krishna Mari Ke. Param will repeat then, Maharaj Parikis, who is also known as Vishnu Rata, one who is always protected by Vishnu, bowed his head to receive the chief guest, Shukadeva Goswami. At that time, all the ignorant women and boys ceased following Srila Shukadeva. Receiving respect from all, Shukadeva Goswami took his exalted seat. Preferred by Srila Prabhupada. On Shukadeva Goswami's arrival at the meeting, everyone except Srila Vyasadeva, Narada, and a few others stood up, and Maharaj Parikshit, who was glad to receive the great devotee at the Lord, bowed down before him with all the limbs of his body. Shukadeva Goswami also exchanged his greetings and reception by embrace, shaking of hands, nodding, and bowing down, especially before his father and Narada Muni. Thus he was offered the presidential seat in the meeting. When he was so received by the king and sages, the street boys and less intelligent women who followed him were struck with wonder and fear. So they retired from their frivolous activities, and everything was full of gravity and calm. Om Gyanjana Jagananjana Salakaya Chakra Nisamjana Sasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manovistam Stapitam Jaina Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Tadati Svapadanti Tam. People gravitate to temples and places of pilgrimage in the world to become purified. A lot of people come to this temple to become purified. And they go to places of pilgrimage in Vrindavan or Tirupati or Madurai or many other places, pouring sacred places to become purified. Unfortunately, in the process, they lead their sinful reactions in those places. And those places tend to become like toxic waste dumps of the consciousness, where people are leaving all their sinful reactions behind. So it's stated in the Bhagavatam that these places of pilgrimage, they get purified and repurified by saintly persons who go to one of them. And we're particularly fortunate that Srila Prabhupada himself came to purify places like this. There's a phrase, holy ground, it's very trite and hackneyed phrase, but all the places we can say where we know that great saints like Srila Prabhupada walked, became purified, and became like holy ground. So, a place of a temple or a deity is not necessarily a purified place, unless it is purified and repurified by the footsteps of great holy sages who, as Bhagavatam states, purify those places, make them pure, and make them places where we can go and become purified. It is natural that human beings want to become purified. It's an interesting statement to Prabhupada make. I'm going to jump in a little bit. Also, this morning I want to read something to you that I read yesterday, which I found very interesting. It's a little on the sociological side, not like yesterday's presentation, but it's a look at this movement in its particular stage of development. And it was written by a professor named Tom Hopkins. Some of you remember him from the Hare Krishna movie film. I think it was called The World of Hare Krishna or something like that. But he talks a little about how Prabhupada was functioning and how in his experience with the devotees wasn't exactly the same as Srila Prabhupada, because they didn't embrace the same values, they didn't grasp fully the same values that Prabhupada did or have the same qualities. So I'm going to read something that he wrote very recently, within a few weeks. Prabhupada writes that, a very interesting statement, it's in the purport to the 31st verse of this chapter. He says, before Maharaj Parikshit, he recited, meaning to the Deva Goswami, Srimad Bhagavatam. Before Maharaj Parikshit, he recited Srimad Bhagavatam and answered the questions of Maharaj Parikshit unhesitatingly. This was said to be the first time he spoke to Srimad Bhagavatam. And thus both master and disciple got salvation. Now we understand that Sukadeva Goswami is already liberated, but according to this statement, both the master and the disciple got salvation by the exchange that took place, by hearing and answering questions. So the indication here is that the speaker is very enthused when good questions are asked, when the hearer is very sincere and wants to hear, asks good questions. The person has to delve very deeply, the speaker, into it's Shravanam, Kirtan, and Smaranam, right? Shravanam is the hearing, Kirtan is the speaking, and Smaranam is remembering. So for one who engages in the Kirtan, or the speaking process, when the hearing process is very alert, very acute, then the Kirtan process becomes more and more enlightened. And the Smaranam process, the remembering process, becomes more and more penetrating. So one who speaks will penetrate more deeply into the hearing. So, Maharaj Parikshit asked very wonderful questions. He was very wrapped in his attention. And the speaker, Sukadeva Goswami, was very keen to not only explain the Bhagavatam, but to explain it as we were reading yesterday, in such a manner that it would liberate the hearer. So he went very deep into the Bhagavatam, and not only recited it, but explained it according to the desire of the hearer. And Prabhupada says something else, which is interesting. I'm jumping a little bit, but we'll go back into these verses. The 35th verse of this chapter says that Lord Krishna, the personality of Godhead, who is very dear to the sons of King Pandu, has accepted me as one of those relatives just to please his great cousins and brothers. This is, of course, Maharaj Parikshit speaking. So towards the end of the purport, Prabhupada writes this. The Lord is so kind that he gives all protection to the family members of his devotee. And thus the devotee has no need to bother about his family members, even if one leaves such family members aside to discharge devotional service. Maharaj Yudhisthira and his brothers were the sons of Kunti, the paternal aunt of Lord Krishna, and Maharaj Parikshit admits the patronage of Lord Krishna because of his being the only grandson of the great Pandavas. We were watching the video of Prabhupada yesterday, the day before. And the theme kept coming up about how he wasn't going to drink tea, he wasn't going to compromise. I think most of you saw that one. And then when he wants his wife to take initiation, she states that she has to have tea. Very important for her to have tea. And in the end, of course, we know that Prabhupada takes sannyas, and it's mainly over this tea issue. She continues to want to drink tea, even though it's a very seemingly insignificant thing. Later, when Prabhupada came to the West, he said that he kept dreaming that his Guru Maharaj, Srila Gopisatha Saraswati, was calling him away to take sannyas. Years before, he'd even thought of it, and he was, in his own words, horrified at the prospect of having to leave his family members and take sannyas. However, when he came to Second Avenue, when he was ensconced in that temple, and many Americans began to come there, he said on one day, it was near the appearance day, his spiritual master, he said that he was very horrified at the prospect of having to leave everything behind and take sannyas, and especially he was very attached to his children. But then he said, but now I have more children. I have more, not only more children, but more caring children. Hundreds, instead of the three or four of mine my own biological or blood relatives. I don't know the exact verse he used. But he said that my point is that whoever takes shelter of Krishna is not a loser. Even though it appears we are giving up so many things that are very near and dear to us, ultimately we will succeed and we will be satisfied, we will be happy, we will be cared for, we will be looked after. As we were reading in the Sutta of Lord Chaitanya, part of surrendering to Krishna is always feeling protected by Krishna. So, and as it is stated in the second canon of Srimad Bhagavatam, family members are like valuable soldiers. They're very important to us, just like all the soldiers that surround us when we go into battle. But if those soldiers are stricken or cut down, we can't do anything. We have to continue to move on. So, and it is also stated in the seventh canto and other sections of the Srimad Bhagavatam that when one becomes a devotee, when one becomes dedicated to devotional service, fully and solely, fully, then one's ancestors and one's, what is it called, progeny or future, I can't think of the word, they're all liberated. Yeah, descendants. For generations, 10 generations, 12 generations, 50 generations, 100 generations, Prabhupada says in different places. So, Krishna is very, very kind. And what was Prahlad Maharaj's desire when he was asked to say anything he wished? It was like, you know, having the magic lamp, you could have anything. Lord Shrimu was right there before him, said, whatever you wish, I'll give you, you can have it. He said, I don't want anything, nothing, nothing for myself. I only want that you should liberate my father. His father, who tried to murder him in so many horrendous ways, thrown into the pit of snakes, into boiling oil off a cliff, into the pit of demons and snakes, and tried in so many ways. He only wanted that his father should deliver it. That's the great compassion of the devotee. So, everything is taken care of by one who surrenders to Krishna. And of course, the surrendering process is not a simple or easy process. We were reading about the six points of surrender. To always accept things favorable, to reject things unfavorable, to always feel dependent upon Krishna's mercies, to always be very meek and humble, to always be dependent on Krishna's mercy, and to always feel protected by Krishna. These are very important things and very difficult things to achieve, to always know what to accept and what to reject. But nevertheless, this is the process of sharanagati, or surrender. Very, very difficult. So, Maharaj prayed because he was given a sign. He knew he only had a few more days to live. He was very receptive. And he's a symbolic of hearing very attentively, very rapidly, because we all know that we have that we forget. And in this consciousness, to know that there's nothing else left, that I have to leave this material world at a certain point, better, he was thinking now than never, sooner than never, that is when he began to hear with great attention. So I'm going to read something that might take a while, and I don't want to be late for the class and go late like I did yesterday. So I'm going to read what Dr. Hopkins wrote about the Sri Hare Krishna movement, and we can have some time for questions afterwards. This is about to be published in the ISKCON Communications Journal. That's why I have an advanced copy of it. This journal, I think, did you get it here? The journal comes out twice a year. Yeah, there was a very controversial article by Richard about child abuse in the last month. So this is not so controversial, but it's about the history of this. Now there's two things that many people say are important. And one is to define what we mean by a member of ISKCON, which we haven't done. Is that someone who's initiated? Is someone who's a life member? Is anyone who thinks I'm a member? And then what is the history of the Hare Krishna movement? And how does that impact on our philosophy, our lifestyle, our study of what Prabhupada is and our philosophy? So this article is called Why Should ISKCON Study Its Own History? By Professor Tom Hopkins, who is now working for the Institute of Vaishnava and Hindu Studies in Oxford. It's run by Sharma Rishi and several devotees. What's that? They also have two nights a week preaching program, so it's a combination of a study center and an ISKCON temple. ISKCON's institutional history is now a little more than 30 years old, if we count A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami's arrival in America as his starting point. Within this time period, roughly generation long, we can see two clear stages. The 1,000 years of dramatic success and worldwide expansion during Prabhupada's lifetime, and the more ambiguous period of both successes and problems since his departure in 1977. In the first of these stages, the seed of ISKCON was planted and a young and vigorous seedling grew under Prabhupada's personal care. In the second stage, his followers have struggled to cultivate and tend the growing plant that has propagated throughout the world during the last 2 decades. Not surprisingly, it is this first stage, the period of Prabhupada's personal leadership and ISKCON's rapid growth, that has received the greatest attention from ISKCON members over the years. A wonderful biography of Prabhupada's journey. Journals of some of his early disciples have been published, and formal talks and even his informal conversations have been collected in several multi-volume series, and archives have been established to preserve and publish his works in various media. At this juncture, we probably know more about Prabhupada's life and works and teachings than we do about the founder of any religious movement in history. Certainly, more than we do the Buddha, Jesus, Muhammad, or even Chaitanya himself. The second stage of ISKCON's history is a very different matter. It is, for one thing, a much more complex story to deal with. Instead of a single major factor to follow the spotlight of attention, there are many different players acting at once in theaters around the world. The drama being played, moreover, is not as unbelievably joyous as that of the earlier years. There are shadows on the stage, dark passages in the story, and not a few examples of human frailty. There is no longer an assumption that nothing can go wrong. The joyous first act gives way to an often painful series of leadership problems, organizational disputes, and internal conflicts, and the clouds of mundane human affairs and human weaknesses often obscure the sun of Prabhupada's infallible grace. There is a natural tendency, therefore, to prefer to replay the first act and avoid looking too carefully at what follows after the curtain closes on Prabhupada's departure. Yet however reasonable this may be, the avoidance of the more recent past in favor of the halcyon days of old has had serious consequences for ISKCON's self-understanding. It is clearly more pleasant to recall the days with Prabhupada, and it is necessary to do so to keep him always at the center of ISKCON's life. It is now more than 20 years since his passing, however, and that is nearly two-thirds of ISKCON's total lifespan. Many important decisions have been made during that period, many changes have occurred, and many new developments have taken place. Some of what has happened has been problematic, and some has been painful, but much of it has been very positive. Most importantly, ISKCON has survived a very difficult stage in its development and is now healthier than it has been for many years. How did this happen? What went wrong in the past and what responses were made that restored ISKCON's health? Without understanding these issues, it will be hard to preserve that healthy condition for the future. ISKCON is certainly not alone in facing such problems with self-understanding. Every major religious tradition has had to deal with the transition from its origins and founding figure to the more problem-fraught period of new leadership and institutional development. Buddhism faced this problem when the Buddha died, forcing his followers to find new ways to preserve his teachings and maintain the monastic community he had founded. The transition was not easy, as we learned from the Buddhist texts produced over the next few centuries. But centuries of hard work and self-examination finally paid off. Scriptures were created to set forth the Buddhist teachings and their implications. Institutions were established to maintain monastic discipline and serve the needs of the householders, and new texts were written to aid Buddhist self-understanding of how all this had come about. 25 centuries later, this early effort is still the foundation of Buddhist life and practice. A better known and even more relevant example is Christianity, which faced internal conflicts even before anything called Christianity existed. Jesus' disciples were clearly confused about who he was and what his teachings meant. They quarreled among themselves about the privileges they might gain when he came to power. And ultimately, one of them, the infamous Judas, betrayed Jesus to the Roman authorities. Peter, Jesus' favorite disciple, and quote the rock, end quote, on whom the later church would stand, twice denied that he knew the arrest of Jesus or had ever followed him. And all of Jesus' disciples believed that the story had ended when he died on the cross. Even after the resurrection, not all of Jesus' closest followers were able to accept what had occurred, and the early emerging community of Christians, or Nazarenes, struggled to understand what had happened and what its consequences might be. A generation later, as we know from the Apostle Paul's New Testament epistles to young churches, there was widespread disagreement among Christian communities about matters of fundamental faith and practice. Much of Paul's career, some 30 or more years after the death of Jesus, was spent on doctrinal, ritual, and organizational disputes that threatened to tear the new church apart. How do we know about these problems in Buddhism and Christianity? Because both religious traditions believed it was important to face the disputes that had beset their early years, describe the conflicts openly, and show how they had been resolved. The same was true of Islam, where the death of the Prophet ushered in a dispute about his successor that has affected Muslim history down to the present day. Efforts to preserve the words of Muhammad have, moreover, led to numerous questions about which words were truly his and when they had been uttered, and witnesses called to resolve the disputes disagreed on the time and circumstances of many sayings. Yet despite the anguish caused by such fundamental disputes and by the sometimes dubious behavior of those involved, the early Muslim chroniclers believed it was essential to preserve a record of what had happened. There is no doubt about the success of these three great world traditions. Buddhism is now well into its third millennium. Christianity is approaching the end of its second millennium. And Islam is still expanding into new areas more than 13 centuries after Muhammad's death. Clearly, they have prospered over the years despite their difficult beginnings. It would be simplistic to credit their historical awareness for all their successes. But awareness of their early problems was certainly a factor in overcoming later challenges. One does not learn how to resolve problems if one denies them, and, in the oft-repeated maxim, one who ignores the past, those who know the past are doomed to repeat it. Facing one's problems does not magically remove them, of course, but it provides the opportunity to learn and grow stronger through a better understanding of the past and a greater awareness of present needs and possibilities. ISKCON, as a continuation of Chaitanya Vaishnavism, is not a new religion, but ISKCON, as an institution, is now still in the first generation of Prabhupada's early disciples, roughly the same point in time when Buddhism, Christianity, and Islam had to deal with their initial crises. It is natural that all newly founded religions would face such decisions at about the same time. The memory of the founder is still strong, but those who knew him personally are getting older, and many new members never met him. New leadership has emerged, and their role, vis-a-vis the founder, is still unclear in terms of the succession of authority. Who should be in charge now? What is his or her right, or perhaps mandate, to initiate new developments in changing circumstances? The community of faithful has grown and faces new challenges. New institutions and new organizational structures are needed, and new opportunities can only be cultivated with new approaches. But who is to make the needed decisions, and how can they be both faithful to the founder's teachings and is permanently divided over the issue of leadership succession after the prophet's death? What is clear, however, is that these religions would never have moved beyond the point of crisis if the questions had been ignored or suppressed. It is hard to face internal conflicts and challenges openly and boldly, but it is deadly not to face them. ISKCON is very fortunate in this situation compared to most other religions. Most obviously, ISKCON possesses a body of its founder's teachings that far surpasses that of any religious movement before modern times. Almost every word that Prabhupada spoke was recorded on the spot, and everything he wrote has been published. Buddhists, by contrast, struggled for generations to remember, collect, and transmit over 40 years of the Buddha's teachings orally, with a further lapse of several centuries before they were first written down. Early Christianity faced another kind of challenge, because Jesus taught a group of newly recruited disciples for only a few short years before his crucifixion. Their differing backgrounds and often conflicting agendas affected how they remembered what he had said, when or where he had said it, and what his sayings meant. The result was three different official accounts of his life and ministry. The three so-called synoptic gospels ascribed to Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and a fourth account, the Gospel of John, which disagrees with the synoptic in its portrayal of Jesus' life and teachings. Early Muslims faced a somewhat different set of problems after Muhammad's death. His ministry and revelations were soon codified in the Quran of Luke's ascension. The leadership of the Muslim community was almost immediately in question. At issue, among other things, was the content and meaning of what Muhammad had said on different occasions about succession to his leadership, whom he most trusted to carry out his wishes, and how the community should conduct itself in matters of morality and law. After long debate, Muslims decided to accept alternative versions or interpretations of Muhammad's sayings, the Hadith, and to legitimate several separate schools of law with different principles of authority. What these examples from Buddhist, Christian, and Muslim history show is that the period after the death of a founder is critical in a religious movement. The movement's continuing life is at stake at this point, because the overriding question is whether it can make a successful transition from the founder's charismatic leadership into an institutional form that will preserve the faith over time. Central to this process, as these examples show, also show, is preserving the message and example of the founder in as many ways as possible. Buddhists did this by collecting, editing, and passing on orally all of the teachings of the Buddha that anyone could remember, along with his rules and directions for the monastic community. Christians did it by preserving Jesus' teachings in a collection of, quote, sayings, end quote, that eventually found their way into narratives of Jesus' life, the three synoptic gospels, and the Gospel of John, which became the foundation documents for Christian faith and practice. Muslims did it by memorizing the Quran, the verbatim record of Muhammad's vision and revelations, and by collecting soon after the Prophet's death all the various versions of his conversations with his followers, the so-called Hadith, or tradition. ISKCON, as noted earlier, has already completed this stage of collecting its founder's teaching well ahead of schedule, thanks in part to modern technology, but thanks also to the foresight of Prabhupada's initial followers who started recording his words and music almost from the beginning of his mission. There are no significant questions in his case about what he said and where he said it, as there clearly are in other religions. His teachings have been published in books, magazines, records, videotapes, and CD-ROMs, and are accessible to anyone who wants to read, see, or hear them. By analogy with other religions, the canonical scriptures of ISKCON have been established, and the final first stage in the transition has been successfully completed. If we look further at other religions, however, we realize that this is only the start of a long-term process. Founders are essential to convey their personal example directly to their followers or disciples, and scriptures are necessary to preserve the founder's teachings for later generations. Without a living tradition, however, both become antiquities. It is too soon now to say that this has happened to Prabhupada and his teachings, but ISKCON still has a direct connection to Prabhupada through present disciples who were with him for many years. There is a tendency in ISKCON today, however, to look on Prabhupada and his teachings as a source of proof text for ad hoc policies and decisions, rather than trying to understand him and the tradition in which he stood more systematically. In what may seem a paradoxical way, it may be necessary to pay less attention to specific statements that Prabhupada made in order to preserve the vitality of what he stood for. Prabhupada himself was constantly changing, not in his essential beliefs and devotional relation to Krishna, but in the decisions he made to meet new circumstances and take advantage of new opportunities. Prabhupada was a living human devotee, and it was his supreme devotional humanness that gave life to ISKCON, rather than any one or even the whole body of his teachings. Nevertheless, it is his teachings and the memory of his living presence in ISKCON. That ISKCON now has to rely upon, along with, and he would certainly be the first to say this, the guidance of Krishna, the divine Godhead. How does one use these properly to keep ISKCON a vital tradition? The answer certainly is not to use them in bits and pieces to support decisions made for more materialistic or egocentric reasons. It is rather to approach Prabhupada, his teachings, and the tradition in which he stood, the tradition of Chaitanya Vaishnavism, as mediated through earlier scriptures and the teachings of Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, in a more systematic manner to provide a dialogue with the past in behalf of the future, on behalf, I think it means, of the future. The name for such a systematic approach is theology, supplemented by what Christians have long called church history. History, that is to say, which assumes the divine basis for the institutions and practices of the religious community, but nonetheless undertakes to study it as a part of human history. This is not to diminish the importance of the scriptures, the founder, or the continuing divine guidance, but rather to take them all with the utmost seriousness as the necessary foundation for the community's ongoing religious life. The purpose of theology and church history, or in this case, Islam history, is rather to maintain a continuous check of the present against the core values and essential doctrines of the larger tradition and the spirit of the founder. It is, in other words, to keep the bright light of trained and devout attention on the way the Lord's human agents are presenting his teachings and managing his affairs. ISKCON is now in a position to undertake such an effort, and needs to do so while Prabhupada's influence is still so powerful in living memory. The effort to create a theological tradition within ISKCON has in fact already started, although there is so far no solid institutional base to provide theological training and maintain an active theological community. The Institute for Vaishnava Studies is trying to develop such a base in the USA, however, and the Center for Vaishnava and Hindu Studies is working to establish a scholarly base at Oxford that could contribute to this effort. There is widespread, if not unanimous, support within ISKCON for developing a community of scholar devotees who could take on the theological task for the movement. And this support should increase as more and more devotees gain the necessary academic training. The study of ISKCON's history, however, has hardly begun with ISKCON itself. Numerous scholars outside ISKCON have studied its history, and some have done excellent work, but non-devotees have neither the personal understanding nor the factual information to carry out a balanced study of ISKCON's institutional history. This task awaits devotees who have the historical training and the institutional support to carry out what will be, even at this early stage of ISKCON's development, a difficult and time-consuming job of collecting the worldwide data of ISKCON's expansion and evolution, organizing it systematically, and trying for the first time to provide a comprehensive understanding of ISKCON's history. In the process, if the job is well done, many of ISKCON's internal problems, the skeletons in its closet, as it were, will be made more evident. But this is why institutional history must be done, and why it should be done by devotees who respect the movement and its members, even as they reveal their defects along with their strengths. ISKCON should study its own history, this is to say, because it needs to do so for its own health and self-understanding. This is not a job to leave to outsiders. Although they may provide scholarly advice, it is a family job, to be done by devotees trained for the task and conscious of the movement's needs as well as the obligations of scholarship. ISKCON's history over the past few decades must be studied with constant reference to what it could be and what it should be on the basis of Prabhupada's fundamental principles, so that strengths can be recognized and built upon, and mistakes can be corrected before they cause future harm. This history must also recognize the changing circumstances within which ISKCON is operating, and in comparison with the past, such as the presence of a worldwide Hindu diaspora that has given ISKCON a new ministry to Hindus abroad. And it must be serious, sustained, and a central part of ISKCON's own program of self-examination and self-improvement. Can this be done? Certainly it can, if there is the will to do it and the support within ISKCON to get it started. But it will take time and commitment to put in place the needed theological and historical resources, both human and material. In the meantime, ISKCON members everywhere should begin thinking about what might aid the process, especially what records, documentation, personal accounts, and local histories are available to fill in the historical record. Much valuable data has no doubt been lost over the years, but devotees should at least now begin to pay more careful attention to preserving the record of the past. There is glorious and glorious past, and it needs to be studied with all the evidence possible, warts and all, and ISKCON. And ISKCON is to remain worthy of Prabhupada's faith in its future. So, that's a perspective from a person who's very involved in working with devotees and been very staunch well-wisher of Prabhupada's movement, and some important insights issued forth from that. Certainly a number of our devotees are studying, becoming qualified to get the kind of systematic perspectives that he talks about here. And it'll be very important for the future. So, I have a few minutes left, I guess. Krishna, we have time deeper. To ask questions or give some thoughts on these matters. And we'll just continue. Tomorrow. Yes.
That's interesting, the point that he made about how the devotees use Prabhupada's words as proof texts. Mm-hmm. You know, like, a lot of times there's arguments on one or two words here and there, and the devotees try to beat each other up on some technical point, but they don't look behind the issue and see how it really affects people in their life, and, you know, sort of consequences.
Yeah. Prabhupada even wrote letters saying that he appreciates devotees who understand the inner meaning of his teachings, so by selective quoting and taking certain words out of context to back a particular issue may be very unproductive, could even prove very fatal, or, as you said, result in people getting in unnecessary arguments. So it does require more thorough study of the whole notion, as he was pointing out, that Prabhupada never compromised, as we were reading yesterday, the original text should never know not the meaning of the original text. New meaning should be screwed out of the text. It should remain constant and pure and perfect, but at the same time, according to context and circumstances, as he pointed out, Prabhupada said different things at different times, and he appeared to be changing externally, because the historical and the cultural context do change, but the essential philosophy doesn't change. So, this is an important insight. Yeah.
Another point, was just my opinion, seeking this book of current, but it seems that a lot of times devotees try to just say, well, this is the right understanding from the Shastra, and you just have to accept it, and this is all there is to it, and the black and white type of thing, without realizing that the reason why ideas might come up that may actually be contradictory to the scriptures is because there's some sort of lacking or emotional need that the people feel. Like, to be more specific. But if you take the Rinpoche, you could look at that and say, well, Prabhupada never said that it's not in his books anywhere, therefore just forget this whole philosophy, and this is the right way to understand it, and if you don't accept this, then just get out, you're useless. Or another way of looking at it is trying to understand, well, why is it that they feel the need to create this philosophy? What's the underlying emotional or sort of sociological cause for it? And dealing with the root cause rather than trying to sort of deal with the superficial problem.
There's sort of a hardcore people who will never be changed. And their thought is that any initiation that took place since Prabhupada's passing is invalid. That people only have the right to initiate on behalf of Prabhupada as a functionary, religious functionaries. There are such persons who probably won't change. What percentage they are of the whole Dhritvik movement is difficult to say. There are hard, those might be the hardcore, you might say, hard Dhritviks. And then there's the soft Dhritviks who want Prabhupada to be more at the center of things, don't necessarily deny initiations. And a number of them could, become more unreplicated, so to speak, and become part of the standard procedures of ISKCON. And I'm sure a lot of them will. What percentage it will be, it's hard to say. But the great upsurge of Ritvikism, or the resurgence of it, has probably come about because some of Prabhupada's disciples feel that some of the gurus in ISKCON have too big of a profile, and they're not very Prabhupada. And so they had started a movement that feels that Prabhupada has been sort of, you know, pushed aside in favor of gurus who want to be the center of things. So guru reform is very much on the cards, coming up. And there was this Dasamalacharya issue, and that sort of lost its momentum. And it was diffused really by a series of articles and behaviors and takers, resolutions, and as it's kind of rising up to the surface again, percolating upward, I'm sure there will be further reform that takes place over the next few years as part of this whole historical view of ISKCON and what Prabhupada wanted. And a lot of it, it's interesting that a lot of the Ritvikism movement is now not calling itself Ritvikism movement. It's calling itself ISKCON reform movement because they don't really believe, a lot of them don't really believe in Ritvikism, which means that no one can initiate except on behalf of Prabhupada. It doesn't count anymore. So that's an indication that, a lot of the impetus for this movement is not really based upon a difference in core philosophy, but a difference in more of a cultural, historical way in which the philosophy is defined. So that's a very interesting comment. So let's look behind the matter. Of course, all approaches will probably be, and I think are, to be necessary. There needs to be some very strong reputation, maybe point by point, of rigid philosophy or papers. There needs to be kind of a simple reputation, but not everyone's going to read the point-by-point detailed reputation. And there also needs to be some very strong, of course, already existing, but maybe there needs to be further strengthening of the fact that those who are convinced that such a philosophy of Ritvikism exists have no place in the ISKCON movement. It's all approaches are actually relevant and important to exist, because there are different variations of commitment to this type of thing.
There are many times these resolutions passed so that establish certain things, but nothing seems to change very much, even though there's the resolutions passed to them, so could I understand that?
Yeah.
It kind of continues on as it was, and continue to get to the root of the real problem.
Yeah, because enlightened leadership or spiritual leadership is one in which they're not really, whatever is said is done, it's followed through, and it's everyone is aware of it, and so on. So, reform not only in the group issues, but in the leadership issues is also very much necessary on our part as part of the historical evolution that has come. There needs to be a constitution, there needs to be more enlightened leadership, there needs to be a deeper understanding of institutional practices of administration, and so on. That's all part of this historical evolution. And as the doctor of history, I think it is, states that despite all these things, that the movement is still in a very good and healthy state because there's a strong commitment to the philosophy of it and what we know of Prabhupada. You have a question?
This is that we'll be dealing with them. Drawing up constitution, it seems to be more of an objective body that was focused on the GDC. It's a bit of a that had more
focus
on
that. Yeah.
Future has started.
Yeah. The constitution and all sorts of social issues are being worked on by people that aren't part of the GDC. Because they can have more time in their hands. And in many ways, therefore, they can be more objective, let's say. So,
It's not hard, is it?
Late breakfast today, it's very late breakfast.
Oh, it's time to see you. What time do you
think
of? Probably get some after
today. Actually, I have to myself leave by 8:30, but we can go another 2 minutes or so.
No, I'm just trying. Not a Christian, but a Christian class. Why is there in our society that people actually don't feel protected by Krishna? Krishna actually says many times, I'll protect that one of the common things you hear all the time. You know, I don't feel I don't feel alive.
Yeah.
But which defeats the very purpose of our whole society.
Mm-hmm. The idea of protection and Sharanagati or surrender is there that despite what happens, we should always feel that Krishna is protecting. And as Falsifar is pointing out, many of our members are not only feeling not protected, but they're actually not protected. And the cases of child abuse are an indication that that is very much the case. It wasn't just a thought, it wasn't just a feeling of an individual, but there was a very, very a serious section of our society that wasn't getting proper protection. And probably still there are sections of our society that are not getting proper protection.
And it's due to many reasons. Part of it is not seeing the proper historical context. Part of it is this kind of selective quoting, like, well, Krishna will protect you. It's there, you know. My devotee will never be my question, and we can find so many quotes of all the Shastras and the Prabhupada said that you're going to be protected. If you don't feel protected, you're in mind. You know? I mean, that's a very simplistic way to reinforce people's feeling about being not protected and to reinforce the non-protection of people. I'm not saying this because you're here, but I always cited, on numerous occasions, I've cited the Christ Church Temple as when I visited there as what I call the high trust culture. Because I think in that place, of course, maybe you know better than I, it's not true, but there was a feeling that people were protected because the Sabbath wasn't locked, the book cabinets weren't locked, and it was a very unusual situation because where I grew up in ISKCON, everything wasn't kind of locked, and you know, it wasn't so, people didn't trust each other so much. The idea is of course found in many of Prabhupada's teachings and in the original seven principles of what ISKCON is, that the members of society should come closer together, which means they should form a family, there should be a kind of unity in diversity, that there should be a sense of protecting. And Prabhupada once said that we shouldn't be surprised by how many people leave this country, by how many people stay in this country. So the whole idea of growth, it can be considered exponential, and if we look at the charts that Swanishai Thakmar sometimes produces, we have this geometric progression that if we have our Namahatas growing in the right way, there'll be 10, and there'll be 100, and there'll be 1,000, and 20,000, and 100 million, and so on. But in 10 years, there'll be hundreds of millions of devotees. But within that, he also makes it very clear that unless every devotee is cared for very well, and feels very cared for, and is actually cared for, then that progression won't happen. Because it's all based upon the idea that I'm fully cared for, and fully protected. Now, for a lot of us, the idea of protection, especially in men, I suppose, is we don't see it as an issue. We think that people who think they have to be protected are just cowards, or they're not understanding the philosophy, or they're not really taking shelter of Krishna. But it's actually the duty we find in the scriptures, and I'm quoting selectively, but I'm talking about things that are throughout the scriptures. We say that we find in the fifth canon, for example, that one should not even consider being a parent or a demigod or a spiritual master, a father, a mother, a protector, a teacher, unless one can deliver one's dependence from death. And that means affection. That means protection. There's an article written in For Bhaktivedanta by a devotee who had this notion that her child should be more surrendered. Child in Gurukul of about 7 or 8. And whenever she said, well, you don't hug me, you don't spend any time with me. So what do you got to be more surrendered? You just got to take shelter of Krishna. Krishna will protect you. So one day while the mother was out milking cows, which was her habit in Gita Nagari, she wasn't getting very much milk. And this went on for several days, and she complained to the person that was in charge of the goshawa. I know this cow's beautiful big cow, they're not giving much milk. What to do? And he said, well, you should have to talk to the cows. You know, they're not just blind, robotic automatons. They're living entities, and you gotta talk to them and make them feel comfortable, and then they'll start giving more milk. So she did that, and the cows started giving more milk. And consistently. And then she thought, well, yeah, that cow's feeling some love and affection for me. So then she said, I'll apply this to my child. And she started spending more time with her child and telling her that she loved her and that doing seemingly mundane things with her. And the child began to be a better performer in the group, or began to understand the philosophy better, began to be a better devotee, began to be more surrendered and felt more protected from Krishna. So this is a very common fallacy that we all experience, that we just think that we can, you know, race on ahead and leave everything behind, and Krishna's going to protect everybody. But we have a society that we have a lot of unprotected people that are either weaker than we are, that are younger than we are, that are in need of nurturing. All of us need that. We all need. Bhakti Tirthamraj has been criticized sometimes because he uses the word love so much. But we actually all need it. I mean, our affection, whatever we want to call it. And it's very true what he's
he's saying that sambandha, which means relationships, is the one of the places where we're very, very weak. Because in every endeavor, everything we do, in Krishna consciousness to spread the movement or to become better devotees, there's a relationship factor that's very important. So we very often tend to overlook, or we do not, we just think that it's, you know, we'll get it from Prabhupada, we'll get it from Krishna, but this affection that we're getting from Prabhupada and from Krishna is supposed to flow through us to everyone else. It's not just supposed to be there between us and Krishna, but it's supposed to be like the great flood of love of God. It's like a great river that raises all the boats. It's supposed to be something that people feel. They want to join Krishna consciousness, or they will want to join and be part of the movement, where they feel that they're part of the team, part of the family, and they feel they're protected. And what are they being protected from? They're being protected from the onslaughts of the lower modes of nature. They're being protected from Maya, which is constantly encroaching upon us and trying to draw us away and to get us into the spirit of enjoyment. And that was the great fear of even Palamar. She said, I'm not afraid of even the Srinidad. All the demigods were pushing him forward because they were afraid of the very fearsome features, the very horrible visage of his, you know, lion feature of the Lord. He said, I'm not afraid of anything, but the material nature is very fearful. And I want you to liberate my father. And even Prabhupada himself said that. He said, I told one of the disciples, you're not in Germany, I want you to pray for me. He said, Prabhupada, you're pure, what can I say, what can I do, how can I pray for you? He said, I want you to pray that I'll never fall down. Of course, Prabhupada would never fall down, but he was citing the fact that he wanted prayer to protect him from Maya, because Maya is so strong. So, it's natural and normal to feel unprotected if we don't have that kind of protection and feeling of openness. But coming from the devotees, it's very important. When we take instruction, we're also taking shelter of devotees. We're not just hearing philosophy from them, we're personally expecting them to care for us, to help our little weak creature develop and grow. And those are just some thoughts. You probably have some better stuff than I do.
It's not right, man. Mm-hmm.
Raji also giving an example in GDC meetings this year that this one's been very good. My father doing things out in the world, but it's been so good as being a mother and looking after the people at home, type of thing.
Yeah, the concept of father and mother is often raised. That what has to be father and mother to people that are new to Krishna consciousness. And the fatherly idea is that you just go out and you make a lot of money and you're building up the dynasty of the empire and you're successful in your preaching. And the mother is the nurturer. The mother is the one who makes sure that you are a stable person, that you're moral and that you feel that you're cared for. We were advising this home family that they should have a family day. They devoted them instead of just preaching. Otherwise the children wouldn't feel that their parents really cared for them. And it worked. It was very good for them. It was good for their Krishna consciousness. So the whole social development, the whole series of social development issues of bonding and support groups and women and children and education are the infrastructure upon which one has to build. If there's no infrastructure, obviously there's not going to be a structure. Just like your temple over here, if you didn't have some very solid, whatever the infrastructure was, metal beams, and you couldn't put the concrete around it, you couldn't have a temple. So, as we've grown, as was kind of indirectly pointed out, we've been very monastic movement. Just the temples of a few people. Now most of the initiated devotees aren't living in the temples. The instruction that he should preach with the courage of a British soldier and the heart of a Bengali mother. So it's kind of all there, you know. Little aphorisms you can find, probably say that. Very important thing. There's great affection is required to preach.
Maharaja, towards the end of Dr. Hopkins' writing, he mentioned that there seemed to be a large expansion of the Hindu religious.
Yeah.
At this time, you used the word like Hindu I'm just wondering, is that going to be difficult for this one in one way, because there's such a disparity, such a growing expansion of the Hindu culture in different ways?
Yeah, it'll definitely be a difficulty because one faces this cultural difference to just like our temple of tongues, like this temple, our congregation, are mainly from the Indian community. And yet, we're living in a community of non-Indian. So sometimes there's a conflict between, you've got a whole group of people here, oh, there's a whole group of other people, they have a different culture than we do. So we have to learn how to not only bridge the two cultures, but how to reach out with Krishna consciousness so that both cultures feel very supported and very protected and very, very much able to advance in Krishna consciousness. It's a challenge that we have to face. And the more we see that it's there, the more we deal with it in a very mature, very enlightened way, the better it will be.
As you walk in, there are so many different Hindu temples in the world. We were the first temple here, and we were presenting Krishna consciousness.
Right.
But now we've got so much
competition.
It's expanding very quickly.
Yeah. We have to be confident that we aren't really competing, because in the most important sense, the Krishna consciousness movement makes all other attempts irrelevant. We have to really understand that we have something to offer. Baba has something to offer. There's no other temple or other organization, Indian or non-Indian, has to offer. And we have to build upon those things that we have to offer. Prashada, directed that connection with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Prabhupada himself, and his followers, and his movement, and his books. That makes the competition irrelevant. We have to understand that that's the case. So I have one more question, and then I'll have to go. Yes?
When I'm speaking about the Hindu, you know that it's kind of especially for Hindu.
Spiritually?
It's not especially for Hindu, so it's for everyone.
It's for everyone, so, right?
I just remember sometime I was in Mauritius and there was Hindus to go to house and there was only a red flag. So I said, oh, Hindu. But because we had white screens, the first morning, and we were going everywhere, Chinese, Muslims, Christian, but if we just stay on the Hindu, I mean, if we just think, oh, we are going to lose all the Hindus, not just to try to preach more everyone.
Yeah, of course we have to understand also other people and their cultures and what their needs and concerns and their interests are and take that into account according to time, best, and circumstance. So many things when we preach. So it's a challenge because it's not a simple matter. Preaching is an art, and an art is not very narrow and doctrinaire. It's very fluid. And it requires a very deep understanding. Anyway, I'll continue tomorrow. Thank you very much.